Good afternoon. We'll call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:36 p.m. on this Monday afternoon, March 12th. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum here today. Co-chair Senator Wagner is excused, but to my left is Senator Stedman, to my right Senator French and Senator Wilikowski, and myself, Senator Pascven. I do expect that we may be joined by Senator McGuire very briefly, and possibly also by Senator Stevens. We have a full agenda today. Everyone that is here is welcome, and we'll try to get through the agenda as promptly as possible. We will hear today, beginning with Senator Thomas's bill, a brief update on the committee substitute for 153, and this relates to natural gas storage tax credit and regulation, and we will also accept some public testimony on that committee substitute. This committee has previously considered the Senate Bill 153 on both February 9th and March 5th. So this is our third hearing. We are joined by Senator Stevens. So this will be our third hearing of this bill. And it is if it is the will of the committee, it is my intent to move the committee substitute for 153 from this committee today. We will also hear for the first time four other pieces of legislation. The first will be Senate Bill 123, Alaska Mining Day. The second, Senate Bill 159, Susitna State Forest. And I see that we're joined by Senator Menard, the bill sponsor. Then we'll hear from Senate Bill 181, closing certain land to mineral entry. And then Senate Bill 205, the Chinook Research and Restoration Endowment. So those are, I see Senator Giesel. I didn't see you there, but she has, Senator Giesel has two bills, Senate Bill 123 and 181. So we also welcome you to the committee today. It is my intent to hear as to those four bills from the bill sponsors and invited testimony, allow for committee questions, and then we would set those bills aside and we will begin public testimony on those four bills Wednesday and Friday. But we'll get right to the first item on the agenda, which is Senator Thomas's 153. Senator Thomas, Mr. Hopkins, please come forward and state your name on the record and give us an update on the committee substitute for 153.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just make a few brief comments and members of the committee as well. As you all already know, the cost of fuel in the state of Alaska is crippling much of the state's economy. The dramatic delivery of fuel oil to Nome helped focus our attention on that as we watched dramatically the transfer or the movement of that fuel through from Russia down to North Korea or wherever, and then back up through the Aleutian Islands and on to Nome. Amazing event. In the interior today, heating fuel costs are $4.68 a gallon. When I last reported to you, they were under $4, and this is kind of natural. Every winter, they pick up a little bit. At the time when I last reported, it was about $660 million that was being spent in the interior on just energy. Now, at the new rate, it would be over $800 million annually for that same amount of fuel. Averages out to about $8,100 per person, every man, woman, and child in the interior, versus the $6,600 that it was last time we talked. While 39% of Golden Valley Electric's cooperative electricity is produced from diesel fuel, which accounts to approximately 60% of the electrical generation budget. With the fuel dollar increase in a gallon of heating fuel since I left Fairbanks, we now pay over $40 for 1 million BTUs. That's the equivalent of about $8.67 paid in South Central. Fairbanksons are currently paying $23.35 for 1,000 cubic feet of gas, 23 cents per kilowatt hour, and as I said, the price of gallon fuel has increased by over one-fifth since I left Fairbanks for Juneau. Individual heating bills of $1,000 to $1,500 a month are not unusual, and our heating season is basically September through April. Totaling $6,000 to $8,000 is not an uncommon number for your winter fuel bill. I know that when I left town, since I left town, I've gotten three bills, I believe, $1,200, was the first one 1,300, and the last one was just over 1,300 as well. Thank goodness spring is supposedly here, although it was still below zero in Fairbanks last week. Senate Bill 153 begins to address this problem by incentivizing the private sector to deliver additional trucked gas to Fairbanks over the next couple, 3 years. And as you know, we have trucked gas into Fairbanks now, but they're limited as to the amount that they can buy. They have a difficulty renewing their contracts with the South Central suppliers because those South Central suppliers are obligated to take care of their customers first. So they cut back sometimes when FNG, who is our truck outfit that brings gas to Fairbanks, and they can't get the desired fuel that they need, that means that some places have to shut down their natural gas generation and turn back on their fuel oil generation, which, like I said, the fuel oil and the gas are not dramatically different now because there's no competition for it. Cost savings from SB 153 is about $15 million or 50% of the construction costs, whichever is less, if we were able to put in place the $15 million in tax credits, which is currently applicable to Cook Inlet's gas storage project, as you know, Singska. We are simply looking to receive that same benefit for our gas storage, although it's above ground storage in tanks versus underground storage. We don't have any depleted wells to fill up with any gas. Anybody looking to take advantage of these tax credits must be a regulated utility because we want to make sure that whatever is received is passed through to the consumer. So the idea is if they are only a regulated utility can use it. This will guarantee that any use of state dollars on any LNG storage facility result in cost savings directly to the consumer. It will also ensure that the North Slope producers or an LNG export facility that are not regulated utilities will not be able to provide and do not provide for consumption of gas at savings to Alaska will not have access to these credits. As I said, Senate Bill 153 with the gas line, well, we've all talked about the gas line quite a bit, and we know that there's some potential for that, but we're still concerned that with the additional gas that is discovered in South Central, we may not see that gas line from the North Slope. So if that project does bring gas to the interior, that's fine. If not, we will still need storage anyhow, one way or the other. We need it either for the trucking or for a gas line coming through. We must find some kind of bridge today for the crippling energy costs and a more permanent source of low-cost energy, and Senate Bill 153 goes a long ways towards doing that. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to note that since this bill was pre-filed in January, received no negative opinions from the public or other utilities. In fact, FNG has expressed support for Senate Bill 153 because it could possibly extend to their storage facilities or a natural gas trucking project should they move forward. Additionally, I would like to thank Senator McGuire for adding her name as a co-sponsor of this bill earlier today, and although not on the committee, Senator Menard for adding her name. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee are due to join me in support of SB 153 and bring some relief to interior Alaskans. Thank you. And my staff, Gar Hopkins, is here to answer any questions you might have and maybe give you a little short update on the specifics of the committee substitute.
Thank you, Senator. And the record should reflect that we've been joined by Senator McGuire. So any questions of Senator Thomas, Senator French?
Either for Senator Thomas or his staff. You brought up Singsa, the Cook Inlet storage facility that we built in Kenai or helped build, and that's why I like this bill is because it seems fair. If we're going to do it in Kenai, we should do it in Fairbanks and other places that have enough people to support such a good idea. But what was the state outlay of state dollars for the Singsa facility, and how much storage did it buy? What's the volume of storage there compared to your idea?
Senator French through the chair. It was that $15 million that Senate Bill 153 caps the storage at for liquid natural gas. That same $15 million was given to Singsa in tax credits. And that was on a volumetric calculation for how much that credit would be. So it was $1.50 for every 1,000 cubic feet stored, and there were 11 billion cubic feet of working gas available stored in that reservoir, and 7 billion feet of cushion gas, it's called, for a total of 18.
And what sort of volumes will you have at your disposal should this bill get signed into law and implemented?
They're looking at 3 million gallons, which comes out to about 360 million cubic feet of gas would be stored in two separate tanks, two-thirds of that on the North Slope and one-third of that in Anchorage. North Pole. It's a long trucking drive.
I knew you meant the North Pole. So something less than a half a billion.
Oh, yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please identify for the record.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'm Grier Hopkins, staff to Senator Joe Thomas.
Senator Stedman has a question.
Yeah, just I'm kind of curious because it looks more like an appropriation bill, and I understand the relationship with Anchorage and their issues. So, kind of go over, if you could, on a broader scope, where this would be applicable to, and who could take advantage of it, and who couldn't, and why we wouldn't do this through a regular capital appropriation process where a utility would come in and they're constrained because of the impacts to the consumer while we try to deal with our energy issue, and we wouldn't make direct appropriations through AEA to accomplish these things.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, through the chair. There are a variety of areas where it could be. There's various size tanks that people would put in. We've had interest for people to actually do propane storage as well in different places. There's been fish processing plants show interest. I think both the towns of Valdez and Cordova have huge issues with their electrical generation as well, and so they're looking for some relief from that. To us, we initially looked at just making sure that the credits that were given in one place would be at least allowable in other places. So it does appear like a appropriation bill. But we're looking at it mainly as a very realistic approach to a problem that we have in the interior. But others are also looking at it as a potential in other parts of the state, southwest, south. East in some of your area as well as Cordova and Valdez, not Valdez, but Cordova and Yakutat have indicated interest, I guess.
Mr.
Yeah, and then maybe just, is there any restrictions on it? I mean, could every town in the state do this and send the bill to the state? Or how do we control and process these type of requests without basically just having communities send us bills and we just pay them?
Well, I think that the probably the only limiting factor is a regulated utility. So I guess that makes it a rather broad-based. So it could be many communities in the state of Alaska could. There's no doubt of that.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I would like to expand on what Senator Thomas said also. If you look on page 3, the very last line, page 31, it lowers that the size of the tank that needs to be built in order to get this tax credit to 25,000 gallons. That was an addition and a change in the House Resources Committee in order to apply, to be able to have some more smaller utilities around the state apply for these tax credits and get the benefit of lower-cost natural gas. Specifically, the idea came up in terms of utilities along the rail belt and along the Richardson Highway specifically, such as the Copper Valley Power Authority, Copper Valley Electricity, I believe, and Alaska Power and Telephone. Both would be able to access it along the same trucking route. There's also been some discussion of being able to, of course, barge gas down the river system to smaller communities and smaller utilities out there. While that does not create the sidebars or limit the number of towns around Alaska that could get access to the tax credits to help them lower their cost, it does create the need, of course, to have gas accessible to them. So I don't see just off the very start there being a huge price tag to this bill above and beyond what's available in Fairbanks right away.
Good, Mr. Chairman. And I know there's a resource committee, a finance committee, but I'm just struggling with this because the term is used as credits, but my impression of the bill is it's not really a credit. It's an equity infusion. We're actually paying the state much like we do with the hydros, up to half with a dollar limit on it, versus a credit where the an individual or an entity would owe the state X amount of dollars, and they take some money off of the bill and send it to the state. So it's, I understand the terminology, but I'm struggling with how it fits what the bill actually is.
Senator Stedman, through the chair. You're correct. House Bill 280, when Representative Mike Hawker introduced that to extend the same tax credit to Tsingsa in Cook Inlet, that was also perceived to be a tax credit. Since that bill passed and that project has been moving forward, it's become a limited liability corporation with a number of different entities working together in partnership to build that that reservoir storage facility. And it also is not paying any taxes to the state, so it's under the same exact situation as Golden Valley would be with this bill, not paying taxes, but instead receiving that equity infusion, as you said.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions of the committee, of the senator or staff? Seeing none, are there any? There's no one signed up here in Juneau to testify to 153. Was there any other invited testimony that the senator had?
I don't think so.
No.
What's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chair, you like a motion, move the bill.
Yes.
I'd move that we move CS for Senate Bill number 153 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Any objection? Seeing none, the bill is so moved. We'll take a brief at ease for purposes of signing.
Thank you.
Back on the record, we now have before us Senate Bill 123. Welcome to you, Senator Giesel, and staff. Please state your name and affiliation, and let's hear about Alaska Mining Day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Kathy Giesel. I'm the senator representing the citizens of District P. That's Eagle River, the South Anchorage Hillside, Turnagain Arm, and Whittier. The bill before you today is Senate Bill 123. It has a very simple title. It's an act establishing May 10 each year as Alaska Mining Day. It's a one-page bill, pretty simple. We all know that that really works, doesn't it? Sometimes the simple ones are the most complex, but this is not true on this one. This bill recognizes the role of the development of mineral resources. and that role in Alaska's history and growth, not only our history, but also our future. The sponsor statement really reviews that history. I'll let you read that on your own. Today, mining continues to be a source of jobs and economic impact in communities where mining has been going on for more than a century. For example, Fort Knox in Fairbanks, Mr. Chair. You and I, both being from Fairbanks, might be pretty familiar with Fort Knox, but that large mine purchases its power from General Golden Valley Electric Association, GVEA, and because of the impact of that power purchase, it lowers the cost of electricity for the consumers in Fairbanks by 1 cent a kilowatt hour. In the future, we're looking at a possible mine in Livengood. They are planning to also purchase power from GVEA. I expect there'll be another significant impact for the ratepayers in Fairbanks. In Nome, there's quite a boom in mining interest. Gold is being found under the coast. As you may remember, historically, gold nuggets were found on the beach in Nome. Well, now they're mining under the water, just off the beach. I was talking with the representative from Nome a couple days ago. He has a one-bedroom house he posted on Craigslist for rent. Within 24 hours, he had more than 30 hits, people interested in renting, because last year they ran out of housing. People were actually living on tents again on the beach in Nome. So quite a resurgence there, and it's having quite an impact economically on the community of Nome. Here we are in Juneau, a community named for Joe Juneau, one of the two original miners in this area. Three very robust mines here built up this community, and today, through the mountains behind us are multiple tunnels that the senator who represents this area apparently used to ride his motorcycle through. Those tunnels, some of them today, are being used to store water for emergency response for fire for this community. In 2010, 100 private sector jobs, new jobs, were created here in the Juneau area at the Kensington Mine. The average wage in mining is $95,000 a year. And in fact, the largest private sector employer here in Juneau is the Greens Creek Mine. So it's having quite a significant impact here in the community of Juneau. Your packet contains lots of historic information about the history of mining, the current impact financially in wages and jobs and taxes paid, and there is a brand new update from Dr. Scott Goldsmith. It's Attachment D, dated March 2012, on the structural analysis of the Alaska economy mining section. So I leave that for you to read. So Senate Bill 123 recognizes the history and the current and future impact of mining. It simply will designate May 10th each year to commemorate that history. My staff, Sharon Long, is here if you have any questions and would like a sectional analysis of this very Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also thank you to you and to Senator Wagner for signing on as a co-sponsor of the bill.
Any questions for the senator or staff? Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, just I noticed there's a research report. And I don't think there's going to be a lot of concern with this. I think it's a good idea to have a designated day like this. But one of the, and the brief descriptions of some of the historic mines, they left off one of the most infamous ones, and that's the Rodman Bay Mine. So the bill sponsor might want to, in her spare time, take a look at that. And just to have a southeast mine that didn't quite get there. Also the Chichikov, which was a real active mine on West Chichikov Island until World War II, and they shut it down because of the war.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman.
Side comments. I mean, it's not.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. And of course, Bokan Mountain contains rare earth elements, and we're looking for quite a robust development there, which will impact Southeast. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We do have Fred Paraday from Anchorage. He's the executive director. Are you on line, Fred?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, please state your name and affiliation and present to the test or to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Fred Paraday. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Miners Association. Alaska Miners Association is a nonprofit organization established in 1939 to represent the mining industry in Alaska, and we are composed of more than 1,400 individual prospectors, geologists, engineers, vendors, suction dredge miners, small family mines, junior mining companies, and major mining companies. We look throughout the state and produce gold, silver, platinum, diamonds, lead, zinc, copper, coal, limestone, sand, gravel, crushed rock, armor rock, and other materials, and our members live and work throughout the state and live in each of your districts. The anniversary of the General Mining Act of the United States is May 10th, making it an appropriate day to celebrate mining. The 1872 mining law, as it's known, governs prospecting and mining for minerals on federal public lands and provides for the acquisition and protection of land tenure rights for mining claims. Minerals aren't discovered in a vacuum. They're a product of a particular technical knowledge and skill coupled with tenacity and risk-taking. Mining was essentially the primary driver to Alaska's early economic development, and cities such as Fairbanks, Juneau, and Nome were founded on mining, and today, the same sort of cities, Fairbanks, Juneau, Kotzebue, Anchorage itself, are reliant on the products of mining and the prosperity we bring to the Alaskan economy. I want to note that mining is also a key driver to the further development of infrastructure across our state. I want to focus on our workforce. The McDowell Report, which we shared with you several weeks ago, provides a direct estimate of the economic impact of mining on Alaska. 4,500 direct jobs. I want to gently correct Senator Geisel in that the new estimate for is $100,000 is the average annual wage in the mining industry. And I'd ask you to replace your mental image of a miner with a sledgehammer to one that's at the controls of a multi-million-dollar, highly computerized piece of equipment that is producing the resources from the earth that we all rely on. Our miners today are highly skilled. It is not an unskilled trade. They have to be knowledgeable of high-pressure hydraulics, high-voltage electronics, rock mechanics, instrumentation, and controls. Alaska is blessed with 7 operating mines, Usabelli Coal Mine, Greens Creek, Red Dog, Fort Knox, Pogo, Kensington, and Nixon Fork. And we have substantial projects moving their way through exploration, including Chuitna, Wishbone Hill, Donlin Gold, Live and Good, Niblack, and Pebble. It's worth noting that there were 60 exploration projects last year spending more than $100,000, with 30 projects spending more than $1 million. That's the leading edge of the next generation of mining in Alaska, the exploration phase. I would like to close by simply moving to one of my all-time favorite quotes, which is from President Abraham Lincoln. And this was written by him in a letter to the miners that were meeting in Denver at the Western Association of Miners. And it was on April 14th, 1865. And his message was, "Tell the miners from me that I shall promote their interests to the utmost of my ability, because their prosperity is the prosperity of the nation. And we shall prove in a very few years that we are indeed the treasury of the world." Mining continues to be the treasury of Alaska and the United States. I would note that the date of that message, April 14th, 1865, later that afternoon he went to the Ford Theater and was assassinated. So it's with a touch of history that I close my testimony and just encourage the adoption of the Senate Bill 123 and the celebration of Mining Day in Alaska on May 10th. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Parody? Senator Stevens has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Fred, just I'm not sure if I'm going on the right track here, but Kodiak Corporation is opening a very large granite quarry on Kodiak Island. It will be a major, very large operation providing armor rock around the country. Do you consider that mining?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stevens, yes, sir, and I apologize that it's not included in my list. I would like to make specific note in context of your question that one of the hidden stories, I think, of mining in modern-day Alaska is that our native corporations benefit from the mining industry activity through 7I and 7J royalty sharing payments, which last year there was $82 million distributed from Red Dog to other Alaska Native regional and village corps. And your example of Kodiak on Kodiak Island is certainly in the same vein. Prosperity lifts all boats, and all boats, and one of the that might have been a Freudian slip, all boats. Prosperity lifts all boats, and one of the things I think it's important to note is that modern mining brings to it the ability to meet modern environmental standards because you are generating wealth and are able to do good work.
Thank you. Good question. Seeing no further questions, we will set aside Senate Bill 123, and we will, again, as I've indicated with all four of the bills, we will hear the public testimony on them Wednesday or Friday. So thank you very much. We now have before us Senate Bill 159, so sit in the state for us. Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for welcoming me. And for the record, I'm Senator Linda Menard, and I represent District G, the Greater Palmer and Wasilla area. And just for perspective, I want to say before I start introducing Senate Bill 159 that the Matsu Borough has 16.1 million acres. This proposed forest land, there is 9.5 million acres in the Matsu Borough, but the proposed state forest, Susitna State Forest, is 763,200 acres. So the forest is like 16.1% of the forest. There's only 8%, which is total forest, but the Susitna State Forest will represent 4%. I just thought that would be just some trivia to help you keep things in perspective. So now for Senate Bill 159. I've been waiting for a long time to put this together. Article 8, Section 4 of the Alaska Constitution addresses sustainable yield. It reads, fish, forests, wildlife, grasslands, and all other replenishable resources belonging to the state shall be utilized, developed, and maintained on the sustainable yield principle, subject to preferences amongst beneficial users. Senate Bill 159 seeks to further accomplish this constitutional mandate by creating the Susitna State Forest. Through Senate Bill 159, the Division of Forestry will be able to manage the state forest for a long-term supply of timber to local processors and retain the land to state ownership for multiple uses. That'll be trapping, mining. We heard just got through hearing about mining, fishing, hunting, just multiple uses. As you see on the maps provided in your packet, the proposed state forest includes 32 parcels totaling approximately 763,200 square acres. The parcels are forestry classified lands and are located in four large management blocks. Legislatively designating a state forest would ensure that some land will remain available for long-term forest management and the region will retain large open spaces of public lands for a range to benefit residents of the region currently that is enjoyed. A state forest designation gives the Division of Forestry the assurance that lands that are managing will be there in perpetuity. And the division is more apt to invest money, and this is very important, they are more apt to invest money and resources towards permanent upgrades. There is also a need to more actively manage lands and vegetation to promote a variety of forest ages to provide for diversity and healthy habitats for wildlife. At the same time, management will also help to reduce wildland fire risks by breaking up large fuel types and encouraging initial regeneration of hardwood species. Senate Bill 159 will set aside groundwork to accomplish all of this. Besides professional mills, the state forest will maintain a supply of hardwood for personal use. Right now, Susitna Valley High School is looking at woody biomass that could heat their entire school. Round chips, chips, wood pellets have become more common and sought out for residential space heating. And it's important to Alaska residents to have a place managed for them to obtain their material. By passing Senate Bill 159, the Susitna State Forest will become the fourth state forest in Alaska. It will be joined by Tanana Valley State Forest. So Tanana is actually the largest. Susitna State Forest would be the second largest. the Haines State Forest and the Susitna East, Southeast State Forest, essentially allowing the MATSU to benefit from all other regions that all other regions have. The Division of Forestry will manage the Susitna State Forest as part of the State Forest System under AS 41-17-200-230, which is the statute that governs the creation of state forests. The division is also required to prepare a management plan for the forest within the 3 years of after its establishment. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Susitna State Forest has been a long time coming. The Division of Forestry has put years of work into this plan, and Alaska is ready for its fourth state forest. We've done lots of research and outreach up and down the Parks Highway. You see letters of support in your packets in the area of the state forest. And this past Thursday, the City of Houston unanimously passed a resolution in support of this bill. And it would have been signed in your packet, but I think the chair or the mayor was sick, and so it'll be here for tomorrow. I thank you for hearing this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions. And I do have Chris Mayish, the state forester. He's the division director here today, do a better job than I can on any technical forestry questions. And I also have with me, I'm sorry, I apologize, my chief of staff, Michael Rivito.
Welcome, Mr. Rivito. Any questions of bill sponsor or staff? Senator French.
Is there any opposition to the bill?
I would defer to you. We're not.
For the record, Michael Rivito, Chief of Staff, Senator Menard. Through the chair, Senator French, we haven't heard any vocal opposition to the creation of a state forest. So the answer to that, the short answer is no opposition.
Congratulations.
I notice in the bill that they have identified the particular parcels, and that seems to compose 90%+ of the bill. I mean, what's the purpose in identifying that, each one of those parcels? Is that how you accumulate to make a forest, so to speak?
may we defer to our Chris Nash?
Certainly.
He's the director of the state.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Chris Mayish. I'm the Director of the Division of Forestry and the State Forester. And to answer your question, Mr. Chairman, the legal descriptions have to be to a high level of details because they become a matter of law in the bill. And so there's actually a lot of effort that goes into the research behind the legal descriptions. And in fact, there will be a more detailed list of applied to this through a committee substitute at some point in the future because there's a lot of small inholdings. It takes a lot of time for the title class section to do the legal descriptions for. If you'll note right now, it just goes to the section level, and for those inholding parcels, we have to describe it actually down to the actual parcel size, which can be small in some cases.
Is there any anticipation on when that process might be completed?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's actually completed, and we just were notified by the title plat section about a week ago that they've completed that process. So we have to put the list together in a Word file and have it checked one more time, and then it's available.
Thank you, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the map, and some of the parcels are not contiguous. Some of them are not touching at all. And can you talk a little bit about I guess, first of all, the law and how what the law requires as far as parcels being contiguous, number one, and number two, if you can also talk a little bit about how these parcels were selected and what kind of public process this has gone through and maybe further process you anticipate.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. Your first question in terms of the number of parcels and the continuity between parcels. All the land on the map you can see, which is the beige color, is owned by the state of Alaska. So even though it's not within the state forest, the state area planning process that has gone through here in this area, there's two area plans that pertain to this area. It's the Susitna Management Area Plan that was just recently signed and approved, and the Southeast Susitna Area Plan talk about access and access corridors. In addition, we will do the same when we, if this bill passes and we have to author a forest or a forest management plan for the state forest, we'll also address access issues. But right now, we have the capability to cross other state lands to access disparate parcels. And if you look at the map, you'll notice that there are some small corridors. Some good examples would be between the East Squintna and the Mount Susitna. Going north-south, there's a small corridor that connects. You'll notice Alexander Creek, there's a small place. So we tried to put continuous blocks together where we could, but that's not always possible, because what we're interested in is the better forest lands, and the better forest lands don't always grow in continuous blocks. But we anticipate no problems with access. The second part of your question was the public process that's gone taken place. As part of the area planning functions, there are numerous public meetings held, in particular over the last 2 years, for the Susitna Management or Susitna Matanuska Area Plan, excuse me. And I don't remember the number of meetings for sure, but there is a paper in your packet, I believe, that goes through the public planning process. And I want to say there was, it was either 19 or 17 separate meetings that were held just for that one area planning process. There were separate meetings held for the Matanuska area plan process. So in addition, in the last 2 weeks, we've been at a number of public meetings up in the valley. We met with the Willow Dog Mushers Association, the Houston City Council, the Talkeetna Community Council, the Matanuska Susitna Borough. And just this weekend on Saturday, there was an open house that Senator Menard hosted, kind of a town hall meeting. And we've had Division of Forestry staff present at all those meetings and all the previous meetings I've discussed. The area plans classify lands as either forestry classified, agriculture, settlement. You know, there's a number of different classifications similar to zoning. And so as part of the area planning process, we brought forward this concept of a state forest for this area. So the concept has been under discussion for a number of years up in the valley.
Follow up.
And just looking at the map, a lot of areas in here, very prolific salmon areas. I know when we talked in my office, I had asked you about setbacks on salmon streams, and can you talk a little bit about that? And I understand there, obviously, there's going to be some logging there, and some of the measures that are put in place to protect the salmon streams.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski would be happy to do that. In fact, you might notice that this map has a addition to it, since the one that I think you first viewed, we added in blue all the legislatively designated corridors that are along the major river systems that were put in place. I want to say that was in the 80s, but I could be wrong. It might have been the 90s. It's I've been doing this too long, I guess. But you'll note that those long corridors provide a significant protection to those major anadromous streams. If I remember correctly, those are quarter-mile buffers on all those major systems. In addition, we have the State's Forest Resources Practices Act. That act divides the state into three different geographic areas, the interior, which is Region 3, the South Central area, which is Region 2, and then Southeast Alaska, which is Region 1. There are various salmon and high-value resident fish protection standards based on the kind of stream, whether it's a large glacial braided system or a small, narrow, freshwater clear system. And the buffer standards that are in the State's Forest Practices Act are tailored to the type of fish and the type of stream in those three different regions of the state. So there is very strong riparian protection standards in place statewide from a forestry practices standpoint. And I might add that those standards affect both public lands and private lands. They are different standards. For example, in interior Alaska, it's a public land standard is 66 foot, and the public land standard is 100 foot. For region, that's region three. And you know, for region two, I don't remember right off the top of my head. I want to say it's the same, but on some stream types, it's quite a bit larger because of the nature of the stream in region two.
Senator Stedman has a question.
Senator Wilkowski's done.
Yeah.
Just, and I've talked to the bill sponsor about this. But looking through this bill, I think it's a good idea that we go forward and you know, create these forests. But you know, we have one forest at 1,800,000, and one at potentially at 763,000, and then the Haynes one at 286,000. Then we got this Southeast Forest at 48,000. which is just a fraction of what we have, and it also has a potential in Southeast of having the best quality timber, I would imagine, the southern part of Southeast, than all the rest of the forests. We're hindered here, Mr. Chairman, in that we've got and are surrounded by the Tongass, which was created, I think, in 1907. And then when Alaska went from territorial status to state status, there was 50-year contracts under discussion for putting in, at that time, I think it was 3 dissolving pulp mill plants. 2 of them were actually built. And we went through statehood and then through the land selection, and I think having 50-year contracts in place within the Tongass, and that is more being one of the major anchors in the communities here for jobs, along with fishing. Southeast didn't really get to participate in the land selection at statehood. So as we fast forward now, we've got no long-term timber contracts. We've got both of our dissolved pulp mills removed, one of them 20 years ago, and the other one coming shortly on 20 years. So I'm not so sure, Mr. Chairman, that we shouldn't take the opportunity of this piece of legislation to ask and encourage the administration to negotiate with the federal government to either get some land out of the Tongass with some of our remaining statehood selections and or just flat out buy it from the federal government and get some of the land in Southeast in state ownership so we can have, you know, a better opportunity to stabilize our communities and create some growth and basically have livable wage jobs. I think the window of opportunity may be better today than it was 10 years ago with the federal government's fiscal position being substantially weaker than it was and ours substantially stronger. So I'd like my committee members to, you know, just give that concept some thought. I know I have spoken with the bill sponsor about that, and I'm not trying to derail the Sitting Forest issue because I want to see that move forward. But I think having a forest bill should be broader, and maybe we don't have the ability here, you know, to lock it down in concrete, but we certainly have the ability to encourage the administration to go forward and start those discussions with the federal government to see if we can, like I say, either select it or flat out buy it. Because 48,000 acres in southern Southeast, it helps a little bit, but it's really, I think, what's the estimate? Maybe 11 million board feet a year, 13 million board feet a year you can sustain off of that?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Stedman, that's correct. It's about 12.8 million, to be exact, board feet a year is the allowable cut.
Which is about one-third what a medium-sized sawmill would need, roughly. So when you look at the ability to, you know, to create jobs and stabilize it so that, you know, that people can get financing where they know they'd have fiber in front of them for 10, 20 years out and longer, it's pretty difficult to do, the structure of the forest now. And the Haynes Forest, you know, just, you know, can't produce it neither. So anyway, I'd like my committee member to give that some thought, and I'll talk with the bill sponsor and see if we can't make this, you know, a broader in scope piece of legislation.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Stedman, I might add, if I can, that the Tongass Timber Task Force is having similar discussions that some of the thoughts that you've just outlined are the same kind of thoughts that are being discussed by that task force. That task force report, I actually chair the task force. The report to the governor is due this July on their recommendations, and there will be an extensive section in that report discussing different options for the Tongass. We've actually are moving that report deadline up. The board or the task force, when it met just 2 weeks back, would like to conclude their work by this May, so that's their new self-imposed deadline because of the urgency they feel with the issues in the Tongass. So I think you can expect to see a detailed report that outlines different options for consideration by the administration and the legislature.
Well,
Senator Stitt.
Can I just follow up with that? I, my understanding, and I was aware that that conversation was going on when I talked to some of the state foresters about this concept in Ketchikan before we started here this winter. But my understanding is that there is some discussion that we may manage part of the Tongass Forest, leaving the ownership within the federal government, but we would potentially as an option, you know, be able to take almost like primacy, similar mm-hmm. to that, where we'd, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that's, you know, that's better than I suppose what we have today, but I think it's far, far more superior position for the state to actually have title to the land, and we're not dictated by California and Florida and Oregon and New York and Massachusetts, how we're going to live and run our communities. So I think unless we actually have the deed, we're still going to be always in the king's forest. And the king seems to get ornerier every decade as far as their ability to live peacefully and harmoniously in our forest, from my opinion.
Sounds like a modern-day Robin Hood.
Yes.
Which I think is probably well-suited to many Alaskans' thinking. So possibly, we've heard that there's going to have to be a CS for this to accommodate the inholdings, so possibly some language might be included in here as well, just if that's something that the committee members were consistent with to send the message that certainly what I've heard about the forests of Southeast Alaska, one would have thought that their acreage would be much greater than interior Alaska, or nothing against Susitna, but again, you would think that that would be one of the primary timber resources of the whole state. So, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. I'd be supportive of that. I know that's hard as a bill sponsor. You don't want to get your own bill built up too heavy so that it just keeps weighted down and never gets over all the hurdles, but I think it's a great idea. And I was thinking about this morning. I brought this in. This is the most recent recreational remote cabin site offering from the Department of Revenue. And I was reminded when Senator Stevens and I served over in the other body, our colleague Hugh Bud Fate brought this idea forward. And it was so controversial. I mean, it could not get out of committee for couple of years, and then finally we got buy-in, and it's wonderful because Alaskans all over the state are taking advantage of this opportunity to get out into the forest and establish cabin sites where their family and the next generations of Alaskans can be in nature and enjoying what it means to be an Alaskan. But it reminded me that with respect to forests, Senator Sedman's right. There's just too much land held in the federal government's hands, and we ought to be working it, using it for the benefit of all Alaskans. And so I'd love to have help. Again, it looks like it's a fairly formal process in terms of staking out those sections. So I don't know what kind of a time period it would take to assemble those particular plots of land, but to the extent that we could have help putting that together, I think that would be excellent.
Senator Wilkowski,
yeah.
Question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you just very briefly explain the practical implications of making this a state forest? What it will enable you to do versus what you can do now, and then also talk a little bit about the impacts on positive or negative or neutral on hunting, fishing, snow machining in this area.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. As far as the multiple use impacts, there really will be no change from current uses that are allowed on state lands versus whether it was a state forest or not. And so all those activities can continue. Based on my experience in the interior with the Tanana Valley State Forest, over time we'll develop more access into the state forest. It's a mixture of all-season roads, fairly low-order type road, and winter access. Those become trails when they're not in use by us, so it actually improves a lot of the recreational opportunities. A lot of mountain bike riding, motorized use is welcome on the state forest by four-wheelers and snow machines. So all those kinds of access routes become a place for people to actually have recreational opportunities. And I'm sorry, what was the first part of your question? I got sidetracked there on the multiple-use part.
It was just on the practical implications of turning this into a state forest.
Yeah, I'd say the most important thing to us as far as a division perspective on this is the long-term nature of designating this as a state forest. It's legislatively designated, and that's very important for a long-term sustained yield of different types of multiple-use opportunities, but to us, wood products. That's one of the key features of a state forest. Opportunities like the high school up in Talkeetna that would like to use woody biomass to do space heating need a long-term commitment of a sustainable resource, and in a state forest, we're guaranteed that type of commitment. We'll in turn make long-term investments in roads, bridges, and other access development that we don't currently make because that land could end up being reclassified for some other use at a future point by another area plan. So it really means a commitment to long-term sustainable management.
And then just follow up. If you can just talk briefly about the quality of the forest products, the timber, is it mostly spruce, birch, a lot of birch kill?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. It varies in different parts of the valley. As you can see, it's quite a large area. It's dispersed. Generally speaking, the forests of the valley are toward the over-mature size in terms of age class and size, which means the hardwoods are declining in terms of quality. There's certainly good quality material out there. But as you know, this is a fire ecosystem, and fire is one of the main ways that these forests are regenerated. It's been quite some time since we've seen a large-scale stand replacement fires in the valley. But that's certainly what the history of those forests stem from, is that type of activity. So any kind of forest management activity we can do to help break up especially conifer types, either black spruce or the white spruce types, or even the mixed stands, is beneficial from a wildland fire standpoint as well as a habitat standpoint. And I didn't fully answer your question from before, but from a hunting standpoint and other personal use activities, various age classes really are a much healthier condition from a wildlife perspective. I think if you speak to wildlife professionals in the valley, you'll hear that there's not enough younger age classes of hardwood species in particular for a lot of the ungulate species that we have in the valley. And so more age classes would improve habitat conditions for those types of species and thus hunting opportunity.
Is there a reason why the mountaintops are not included within the forest? In other words, it seems like right in the middle of the forest there's these donut holes.
Yes, Mr. Chair. If there were trees on them, we probably would have included them.
Is that so, the tree line?
But yeah, pretty much. You hit a tree line, and so we were trying to focus the state forest on areas that would be good places to manage for timber production and would be stands that would be considered higher site class, which means higher quality. So they're good lands to manage trees and vegetation on. The other point is access. Of course, steeper ground is more difficult to access and build access to. But in this case, it's really this is where the trees are in these green areas on the map, or the best trees.
Well, we thank the bill sponsor. Again, we will hear public testimony on this later this week. Any further questions of Mr. Mache? Senator, please.
Again, I'm Senator Linda Minar, District G, and I'd just like to respond to maybe Senator Stedman's concern. Perhaps maybe a very strong Senate resolution encouraging the governor to get with the, and allow these federal lands so it will ultimately benefit all state forests would be a way that would certainly be helpful, I believe. I am concerned that if we hold this up, of course, May, even as Chris said, his task force should have the results, and but that would be in May, and of course, you know, by then we'll be adjourned. So I think this is very good legislation, and I'd certainly like to see it moved.
Thank you, Senator. And
thank you very much for hearing.
So we will set Senate Bill 159 aside, and we'll conduct public hearing on that later this week. We now have Senate Bill 181. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Kathy Giesel. I am the senator representing the citizens of District P. That's Eagle River, South Anchorage, Hillside, Turnagain Arm, and Whittier. Senate Bill 181 would close certain lands to mineral entry, in other words, mining claims. Girdwood is a community in my district and is home to Alyeska Ski Resort, the largest recreational facility of its kind in our state. Girdwood also has multiple world-class hiking, cross-country running, mountain biking, and Nordic ski trails. In fact, Mr. Chair, as an aside, Senator French is quite an accomplished Nordic skier, and he would probably be interested in the beautiful new trail that they are building in the Girdwood area. In any case, Girdwood is a year-round recreational destination for Alaskans and visitors to our state as well. Senate Bill 181 allows for the expansion of these recreational opportunities in the mountains to the east of the ski resort by closing additional state lands in the Glacier and Winter Creek areas to mining claims. Now, in your packet, you have a map that looks like this, and it's nicely colored. It kind of helps navigate this bill. A large portion of this land has already been closed. It's the blue area here right in the middle. It's been closed since 1992 to mining claims by action of the legislature, and that closure has recently been extended by legislative delegated authority to the DNR commissioner. SB 181 will complete some necessary additional land closures in that area for recreational use. There's widespread support for this bill from private persons who live in the Girdwood area as well as Girdwood businesses. In fact, even the Alaska Mining Association supports this bill. Of really great significance to me, one of my constituents in Hope, who is a placer miner, recently went into this area and poked around and reported that, in fact, he supports this bill as well, as he sees no significant mining opportunities on this land that we're discussing here. Of note, this bill will have no impact on Crow Creek area, which is still an active gold mining area, and it's several miles to the southwest. Mr. Chair, the bill is somewhat complex. Sharon Long, my chief of staff, is here to take you through a sectional analysis, and we have a couple people from DNR who can also answer technical questions.
If I may?
Yes. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Resources Committee. My name is Sharon Long. I'm staff to Senator Kathy Giesel. Section 1 of the bill states that the purpose of the act is to approve the interim classifications contained in Mineral Order Number 121. That's the gold area and a little bit of the blue area on your map. And Amendment 3 to mineral closing orders that were issued by the Commissioner of Natural Resources. Section 2, over on page 2, identifies the land in the Glacier Creek and Winter Creek drainages that's closed to new mineral entry. And Section 3, on page 3, amends the description of the land in the Glacier Creek and Winter Creek drainages that were closed to mineral entry and approved by the legislature in Section 2, Chapter 8, SLA 2003, a bill that Senator French was a cross-sponsor of, by excluding two additional mining claim recordations that were left out in that legislation. And Section 4 provides for an immediate effective date.
On page 1, line 12, it talks about new mineral entry. It seems to infer that there's current or ongoing mineral activity there, or is that a wrong assumption?
My understanding is that the lands in the blue area on your map have been closed to mineral entry since 1992, and then extended again for a 10-year period, extended again in 2003. And the new mineral order, which was issued this last year, is the gold area. I'm unaware of mining activity in that area, but Mr. Wynn Menefee, who's the Deputy Director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, is here and can probably speak to the specifics of any claims there.
Just more of a technical question as to whether there was current ongoing mineral activity in that area.
Would you like him to answer that?
If he may.
I'm Wynn Menefee, Chief Operations for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water with the Department of Natural Resources. Chairman, the answer to your question is that there's no mineral claims or locations within this area except for those federal mineral locations that are up Crow Creek area. And those were in existence actually prior to the original mineral closing order.
Okay, thank you.
We, Senator, did you have any additional? We have Fred Parity all prepared. He's invited, I believe, to testify.
We had heard that you preferred to hold testimony until Wednesday, but if he's online and prepared to testify.
Yeah, if it's fine. Invited testimony, in other words, why don't we just hear from Mr. Parity? Are you, Fred, are you available?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Fred Parity, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association. And I'm testifying today in support of Senate Bill 181, closing lands to mineral entry. As I stated in my earlier testimony this afternoon, the Alaska Miners Association is a nonprofit organization established in 1939 that composed of more than 1,400 individual members. We recently took up the questions that are addressed in Senate Bill 181 regarding the mineral closure order in the Glacier and Winter Creek drainages in the Girdwood area. While some may find it surprising that the Alaska Miners Association supports this bill, we are specifically appreciative of the process followed by DNR in evaluating the proposed areas as to their mineral potential and other values. We support the closure orders and agree with the assessment that these lands are properly suitable for expansion of the recreation uses. And we would note that should such use cease, we would like to see the closure orders reversed and the areas reopened to mineral development, although that's highly speculative given the extensive nature of the recreation development and the limited potential for minerals. Nonetheless, in the future, should such a situation occur, you never know what might happen. Again, we appreciate the chance to comment. We support the effort to accomplish these particular withdrawals, and we thank all of you for your consideration of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Parity. Any questions? Seeing none, we thank you. We will set Senate Bill 181 aside at this time, and again, we will conduct public testimony on all these bills later this week. But we now have, hopefully, just enough time. We have about 15 minutes. We now have before us Senate Bill 205. Mr. Scott, welcome to Senate Resources. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Senate Bill 205.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm David Scott, staff to Senator Olson. Senator Olson sends his regards. He may make it down here briefly.
And if before we get going, I believe we need to bring the committee substitute. May I have a motion?
Thank you,
Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we move CS for Senate Bill 205 Version D before the committee.
Any objections? Seeing none, the Version D is before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, David Scott, Senator Senator Olson. Version D, it mirrors, is identical to the companion bill in the House that's gone through two committees already. We're trying to chug along at the same pace, which is why there's a CS. That's not to say that we don't think that this committee should not offer its own changes if they feel right, and the sponsor would welcome any friendly amendment that would make the bill stronger and better. The bill itself, Mr. Chairman, creates an endowment fund in AS 3714, which is the trust fund section, and there's nine other trust funds in that section 3714. It creates a trust fund to establish a long-term source of funding to what we would call support as high-quality interdisciplinary research on king salmon. Chinook salmon or king salmon. I'm from Southeast, so I call them kings. I don't call them Chinooks. It goes without saying, you know, in 2010, the Yukon Kings were considered a failure. They were declared a failure by the federal government, by Commissioner or Secretary Locke from the Department of Commerce. There's also, of the 14 stocks of concern in the state, eight of them are king salmon stocks. We feel it's time to augment what the Department of Fish and Game has been doing. They need to, Fish and Game is working hard on this, no doubt on their side. We feel that there needs to be a little augmentation, hopefully from the private sector, on trying to figure out why the abundance of king salmon has fallen so much in the state. With that, I could go into sectional analysis if you'd like.
Certainly, I think it'd be useful to kind of get us up to speed on exactly what it is that you're advancing, or Senator is advancing. So.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. The bill is a it's one of those bills that it's on its face it's one section, but in it there are several sections within the one section. So section 3714650 establishes the Chinook Salmon Research and Restoration Fund. Section 3714655, after this I'll just go 655660, establishes the grant account in the general fund. Now, and I think if we're all familiar how this works is the fund would make the money, and then the legislature would appropriate what money they felt appropriate to the grant fund, and then from the grant fund the board, which is created later, would award grants to Alaskan entities that will put forward projects for restoration or research regarding king salmon. 660 is where the Commission of Revenue will identify the available availability of funds to be appropriated to the grant from the fund to the grant fund, from the restoration fund to the grant fund and the general fund. 665 is relates to what the appropriations of the grants account may be used for. To be specific, is grants for research and restoration projects. And what we did is we changed the research and restoration to research or restoration, so that we're not so we don't limit those. They could also be used for reimbursements to the Department of Revenue for the cost of establishing and managing the fund, reimbursements to Department of Commerce for the cost of establishing and administering the board and the grant program. And they may also be used for matching funds for private and federal grants and solicit contributions for purposes consistent with establishment of the fund. The board may also expend private donations for use is consistent with the fund and the purposes of the grantee of private funds. 670 establishes the board. The board 675 is further specifies who's on the board. They're all appointed by the governor. There includes the commissioner of Fish and Game and then six public members, one each residing in from Southeast, South Central, Southwest, Western, Arctic, and Interior. They must be engaged somehow in subsistence, personal, sport, or commercial use of king salmon. 680 is how the board will administer the program. Gives the reg authority. That's kind of cookie cutter language in 680. 685, so when reviewing grant applications, the board consider whether the Chinooks, where the king salmon are targeted in the grant, or if they're significant to Alaskans. We don't want to award projects where they're not needed. We're trying to focus with that. We're trying to focus the awarding of grants to stocks that are needed, that need the attention. The board will also whether the applicant has appropriate experience. Obviously, we don't want anybody just to form a nonprofit and then get money through a grant process of state money and not have any experience whatsoever, no scientific experience whatsoever. When reviewing grant applications, the board must consider recommendations of state agencies or organizations involved in salmon management. It also states that the board will give priority grants that target king salmon stocks that are stocks of concern, and those are listed by the Department of Fish and Game, that are subject to state or federal fisheries disaster declaration, that are closed or significantly restricted or declined significantly from historic yields. And section 695 is definitions. I could also go over changes if you'd like from the previous bill to this.
Senator French has a question.
Oh, yeah. I have a question about the definition section, page 6. Line 31. I wonder if you just pronounce those words for me, please.
It's Greek for king salmon.
Greek. Very good. Excellent answer, Mr. Scott. Thank you,
Mr.
Chairman.
Very good answer. Further questions of Mr. Scott? We thank you. We also have on the line, we have Scott Rudy, the Director of Division of Community and Regional Affairs. He's available for questions if anyone on the committee has any questions of him. And then we have also Eric Volk and Bob Clark from the Department of Fish and Game on the line if anyone has questions of the Department of Fish and Game. Seeing none, we thank the people that are holding online. I don't see any questions. Any other questions of Mr. Scott? Any additional information that the committee would like to receive with respect to Senate Bill 205? Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, on page 5, line 20, references the Alaska Yukon Kuskokwim Sustainable Salmon Initiative. I'm not sure what that is offhand, not being from the area, and how that would implicate the process here dealing with the potential awards. So maybe
could you use that page number again?
At page 5?
Line
5, page 5, line 20.
On version D,
on version
mine
D.
Is keep electronic records. Well,
I'm on version M.
Possibly.
Or I can get with the bill sponsor, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Scott, can you possibly, is that in
Senator,
version D? That's, I guess, the appropriate question to start with.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, we did, we removed that specific language in version D.
Well, he's no fun tonight.
Any other questions of Senator Stevens has a question for you.
So this is truly, Mr. Chairman, it's truly a statewide level of case. We're not zeroing in on one individual area working. All of us have problems.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, that's correct. It's a state resource. We can't, I don't think, coming from Southeast, I wouldn't be happy about a bunch of money going to just some salmon research somewhere else in the state. So it's a state resource that we're all looking in on.
Any other questions of Mr. Scott? Again, we thank you. I think we've gotten through the original Senate Bill 153 and all of the four bills this afternoon. So given that, Senate resources for this Monday, March 12th, is adjourned.